Welcome to Tentpole Trauma, the podcast where we look at movies that came with hype and high hopes, but left with crushing disappointment, either critically, at the box office, or both. Freed from the weight of expectations, we seek to examine these underperformers under a new light, parsing through the good, the bad, and everything in between with the hopes of gaining a better understanding as to why they failed to find their audience. Warning, there will be spoilers, so if you haven't seen the movie that we're discussing today, I suggest you stop the podcast and go watch it. Then when you come back and listen, you'll get more out of the discussion. On this episode, we discuss Crimes of the Future. I'm Sebastian, and I'm here with Troy.
Hello.
This episode, we are discussing Crimes of the Future by famed Canadian director David Cronenberg, his return to the sci-fi body horror genre, which he pretty much created, I would say. Now, Troy, you are pretty much the biggest Cronenberg fan that I know. I consider myself a pretty big Cronenberg fan, but you are, I think, the biggest Cronenberg fan I know.
I never considered you a big Cronenberg fan for some reason. Maybe it's because my level of Cronenberg fandom is so astronomical that I always thought that, you know, you dabbled in the...
Are you gatekeeping me out of the Cronenberg fandom, Troy?
Yeah. So you consider yourself a big fan.
I consider myself a fan. I wouldn't
a
use
because you didn't run out to see this movie in the theaters, which I did.
Yes.
Which I had tickets like a month early for this thing.
Yes, this was your Phantom Menace. Troy was as excited about this movie as Star Wars fans were about the Phantom Menace back in 1999. Would you say that's an accurate description?
Yeah, that's totally accurate. And I think I was telling you, in preparation to be let down by this movie, I decided that I would at least give myself like a month to think it might be the greatest thing he's ever done, just to have that joy for a month.
And we will discuss how that worked out for you. But first, why don't you talk a little bit about Cronenberg and then talk about some of your favorite Cronenberg movies?
I don't actually remember like when I first saw David Cronenberg movie, but it must have been Videodrome. And I know I saw all these at like a really early age. A lot of them came up, like a lot of these things in Fangoria, you know, they would showcase a lot of his work. He was definitely one of the first directors that I became aware of as like a director. Like you start learning that like, oh, this guy made this movie and this movie too, you know, same with John Carpenter. But I fell in love with his ideas pretty much immediately. Once I saw like The Brood and Scanners and Videodrome, I was already a fan. And then I clearly remember being excited for The Fly to come out. Was that like 86?
Yeah.
So I remember like the hype for The Fly. They're going to remake this thing. It's going to be David Cronenberg. And I think I had seen all of it. Maybe I hadn't seen Rabbit or Shivers yet. And some of his more obscure ones like Fast Company or something, but I was already pretty much a big fan by the time The Fly came out. And The Fly blew me away. That was kind of his peak, I would say.
I think you could make an argument for Dead Ringers.
That's right after The Fly. So that's kind of like when he's at the top of his game.
Yeah.
The Fly, that was like a commercial hit. and big with mainstream audiences. And then Dead Ringers might be noted as like his, maybe one of his best films critically. But yeah, after that, I would always make a point of going out to see his movies and like watching what was happening if he was in pre-production with anything. I even went to see The Fly opera. I dragged my wife to it.
Wow.
That was a big mistake. But I even got tickets and went to the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion in Los Angeles to see The Fly opera, which he directed.
Yeah, that definitely qualifies you as a bigger fan than me. I wasn't fully aware of Cronenberg as a director until probably The Fly. I had definitely seen Dead Zone in the theater. I was aware of The Brood. I don't know if I saw it at that point, but I was definitely aware of it. I was also aware of Scanners because of the head exploding. You know, like every kid knew that that happened in a movie in the early 80s, even if you hadn't seen it yet.
Yeah.
So I definitely was familiar with his films. And then by the time The Fly hit, which I also loved, I became aware of him as a director. And I didn't really start really kind of keying in on what he was doing and what he was about until the 90s. And I think the movie for me that really kind of crystallized Cronenberg was Naked Lunch, which is a movie that I actually really love. And I know it's not necessarily one of his most popular or well-regarded movies. I think it's probably in the middle of its canon.
It's in the middle, yeah.
For whatever reason, I mean, I think it was just the age I was at. I was like, you know, college kid smoking a lot of pot, and that movie is really fun to watch high because of all the surrealistic imagery.
And it's about a drug addict.
Right.
Front and center.
If you're at all into drug culture, that yeah. movie will really work gangbusters for you.
One of the most famous drug addicts.
Yes.
And also, I think with Naked Lunch, that arrived at a time when David Cronenberg already had this body of work, and now he's sort of making a film about and telling you, like, this is my influence. Like, this is one, the person who kind of inspired my work. I'm going to make a movie about him, about this book that you can't adapt. Like, I'm going to take this on. And nobody really knew what to expect with it. But it sort of had his whole thesis wrapped up in that movie.
Totally.
So you could unpackage a lot about David Cronenberg just from everything he was sort of putting on the table with that movie.
From then on, I definitely was paying attention to him, and I had an idea in my head of what a David Cronenberg movie was. By the time we get to Existenz, I saw Existenz, I think, on video. I didn't see it in the theater, which, again, marks me as not a true fan. But that one kind of lost me a little bit, and I know it's highly regarded now, but I just couldn't really wrap my head around it. Maybe it was just the zeitgeist. I mean, there's been a lot of talk about how it's kind of the antithetical Matrix, because the Matrix came out around the same time, and they deal a lot with some similar themes.
Right.
And so it wasn't that I didn't like it. I was just like, huh. And then after that, he has a couple of bad movies, right? Like Spider.
Before Existenz, you had M. Butterfly and Crash. People had mixed reactions about Crash as well.
People hated Crash, and now people suddenly love it. It's one of those movies where people are now like, Crash is great. We're not talking about the 2000s Crash. We're talking about the 90s Crash.
Yes. But I loved Crash, but I remember people that did not land well with even Cronenberg fans. And it was, so you already had M. Butterfly, which was basically just based on a play. It was rather kind of drab. It was just kind of a drama, and people are like, oh, I guess is he leaving genre films behind now? And is he trying to just do hard dramatic adaptations? So when Existenz came out, for me anyway, I went to see it in the theater and I was psyched. Like when the movie ended, I was like, he's back. This is absolutely a companion piece to Videodrome and Naked Lunch. Like, it just fits exactly right in with the same structure. It's dealing with the same themes. It's body horror. It's about virtual reality. So it's this hallucinogenic world that these people are living in. Everything that was in Existenz was what he had been dealing with his most exciting films. And so I thought it was great, but you're right. I think that because The Matrix had just come out, they sort of read this film as a lesser Matrix. Like, they had already been blown away by alternate reality. And Existence was a little bit more of an artsy, muddled version of that.
It's an unfair comparison because they don't have the same objectives at all, but
yeah,
you can see why people at the time were like kind of dismissive of it.
Then David Cronenberg, what did he do? After Existence came Spider, which I was so excited for that I read the book in anticipation. And I think you and I were roommates at that point. I was like, this book sucks. It's totally boring. Can't wait to see the movie.
And then when you saw it, your reaction made it so that I never saw it.
You've never seen Spider.
You were like, this is awful and boring. Why should I watch it?
Well, that still kind of stands. And then A History of Violence, I went to the premiere of that. I actually met David Cronenberg.
Oh, cool.
That was at the Egyptian in Los Angeles. It was like a small premiere, a chance where I actually got to go up and be a fan and like, oh my God, Mr. Cronenberg changed my life. You know, I was like, got a chance to act like an idiot in front of him. So
I do like that movie. I know it's not really in the body horror canon, but no. I think it's a good movie.
Yeah. I watch it again and it's actually a very funny film, and it's his dry humor is getting stronger in that, more stronger. He always kind of had a sense of humor in his earlier works, but I think now he's sort of doing adaptations. You know, again, we're wondering, is he leaving this body horror and horror genre in general behind? Now he's getting into suspense movies. And then he followed that one immediately up 2 years later with Eastern Promises. I think both of those are based on graphic novels.
And they both star Viggo Mortensen, so it feels like of a piece. I saw Eastern Promises. I liked it, but I don't remember hardly anything about it. I think there's like a fight in a bathhouse or something.
Yeah, that's all anybody remembers from that movie is the naked fight in the bathhouse that lasts like 7 minutes long or something.
It's like one of those movies while I was watching it, I was like, oh, this is good. And I've never felt the need to ever revisit it ever.
I only revisited it when I was getting ready for Crimes of the Future. I was like, oh, this is kind of a sweet movie.
But what about like Cosmopolis? Do you like that one?
Oh, man. So then, okay, he had Dangerous Method right after Eastern Promises, which that movie, that's when I was like, I hate everything. Now I officially just hate everything that's going on here.
I haven't even seen that. I have no idea what it even is.
It's just so drab. And then, yeah, Cosmopolis seemed like, based on the trailer, it looked like, oh, wow, this looks like we might be heading back into at least a Cronenberg world. You know, you saw like this giant rat crawling on top of a cab, and it kind of had this eerie dystopian sensibility to it, at least in the trailer. And then so when I saw it, I think that was one of those movies. Now we're getting sort of into that territory of Star Wars fans anticipating The Phantom Menace. Like, I'm going to like this movie no matter what, as I'm sitting through it. And that was kind of my attitude going into Cosmopolis. As I was watching it, I kept thinking like, this is good. And I still revisiting that movie. There's stuff in it that I like. I think the tone of it is really cool. You know, it has this sort of dark edginess to it. And it does have a strange sort of sci-fi element to it. They have this kind of bizarre weapons that they're using in it. And the cab itself almost feels, or his limousine feels like a spaceship. And it's got like, you know, some futuristic interfaces and screens that are going on.
And it's got my boy R-Pat. So I definitely have to watch it one of these days.
And R-Pat is pretty great in it.
He's always great.
Yeah.
Except in Twilight, where he's clearly trying not to be great.
Right. I've never seen Twilight.
That's the only thing he's bad in, honestly.
Yeah. Then we get to Maps to the Stars, and that's a pretty forgettable movie, too. That's a straight up kind of comedy. So pretty much since Existence, like, you know, he's just been out trying to do different, attack different genres, taking a stab at this and trying different things. And fans sort of never thought he was going to return. And there was sort of this, you know, people who they're like, you know, Cronenberg's early works, and that's only what we're going to talk about. So when Crimes of the Future was announced, it was a big deal. And it's based on his first student film.
Right. And you recently rewatched that, right?
Yeah, and I just looked at it again last night.
Why don't you tell our audience a little bit about that before we get into the new one?
So this is a movie he made. I think he was still in college. If not, he was still dealing with his college professors and colleagues but it is shot, I believe, at the college he went to. I could be wrong, but it is definitely shot at some kind of university. And it's this, I think they were shooting it in 1969, but the style of architecture for this place is this futuristic, brutalist architecture.
I love that shit.
Yeah, it's like it's all cement and it's these impossible angles and you can't tell if it's like an office or if it's a prison. I've kind of fallen in love with this style of architecture as well. But anyways, Crimes of the Future, it's definitely for Cronenberg fans only. It is absolutely a student film. It's feature length, but it doesn't have sync sound. He's just shooting people walking around in front of the camera. They're not even in any kind of costumes, really. They're just meandering around this environment, the setting. And then there's a narrator. And there's not even really a score or soundtrack or anything. There's just experimental noise laid on top of it.
Yeah.
But it's kind of fascinating if you want to sort of explore his roots, because he's sort of putting his ideas out there on the table. It's definitely science fiction. It's dealing with a world in which people are having to adapt to a catastrophe that happened. There's no more women alive. It's a little unclear why that is happening. That could be a bit of misogyny. Mm-hmm. But I think I read somewhere that they all died of cosmetic poisoning.
All women died of this.
It's not his most woke film, I'd say. So there's these handful of people at this institute called the House of Skin. They're doing this research to try to figure out how they can repopulate the Earth. I think one of the only connections to the new film is there's a character in there who is growing new organs and removing them surgically. But I actually kind of think the original idea is more interesting. We'll get into how this plays into the new version. But in this version, they mentioned that as he's having these organs removed, he's having this melancholic sense of loss because it's part of his body that he's losing. And he almost feels like he wants to remain in contact with them, which I thought was a really interesting idea.
That is cool.
Anyways, that's basically the only connection. But the ending of this student film is actually pretty incredible. It's completely nightmarish, totally disturbing, and would never be able to be made into any kind of mainstream film. But I feel like you can see where he likes to leave his films. Like, after that, he has always kind of left his films with these sort of absolutist, extreme thing that might happen to his main character.
Right. There's always like a final idea, and the final idea is always kind of upsetting.
Yeah, that's right. And so you can see that in this student film, however problematic it is, but it's there and you sort of see how he uses that as a structure device later on, this upsetting finale, which we will have in the new version of Crimes of the Future. And I am going to say I was upset by it, by how lame it was.
Well, let's get into the Crimes of the Future 2022 then.
Okay.
Why don't you give us your take on it? Did you like it? Did you hate it? How do you feel?
All right. So, of course, I had this excitement that Cronenberg was returning to his roots. He was getting back into body horror. There was no question about that. If you saw the trailer, like, he's totally going without question back to his early works. The big question was, is he going to still be able to reach that place where he was with Videodrome and Naked Lunch and The Brood? So going into it, the first thing is the score was cool. Again, he's using Howard Shore, who's done pretty much almost all of his films.
Yeah.
Howard Shore has been his main guy since the beginning. And you get this new synth score from Howard Shore, which is actually pretty awesome. But yeah, the movie starts off with a mother killing her child. First you see this child and she's like, he's playing out at the beach and she's like, don't eat anything out of that water.
Yeah.
I don't care what it is. Don't eat anything. You know, and you've got this weird score happening and there's a overturned, like a cargo ship that's turned. So you see like we're in a weird world that looks like it's this dystopian world where things are falling apart. And this kid, at that night starts eating the wastebasket in his bathroom.
Can I just say, I loved this. All right. Like this whole opening I thought was great. And
wow.
Like, I'm watching this because you prepared me. You sort of expressed your negative views on this film. So I was really prepared to not enjoy this movie.
Your bar was set at the very bottom.
Right. And like, okay, this isn't going to give me anything I want. Nope. First 5 minutes, there's a little kid eating a fucking plastic waste paper basket, and then his mother smothers him with a pillow. I am like, okay, I am on board. Like, you kill a child in your first 5 minutes and you have my attention, sir. And I mean, you got to at least admit, like, this is pretty hardcore. I mean, if you're worried if he doesn't have the guts anymore, I think this is a pretty clear statement that he's not afraid to do anything.
So I'll hand that to you. I didn't quite get as excited about this opening as you did, maybe. But
why not?
Well, first of all, I couldn't understand a single word that woman was. So right after she kills this child, she calls her ex-husband or something. And I can't understand anything she's saying.
I love it, too. She calls him on like a military cell phone.
Yeah.
So right away, just the production design and stuff that's going on, which is pretty minimal. I would say that I think he creates a pretty effective world with very little. Now, the budget for this movie was $27 million, and it did only make $4.51 million. So this is definitely a tentpole trauma.
I didn't realize the budget was that high.
I would say I don't really see the money there necessarily. Like, this looks like a really well done $10 million
movie. I had no idea it was actually closer to 30, but there's a lot of huge names in it.
Right. Like, I think maybe that's what's taking up some of the budget, but not in this opening scene. These are unknowns as far as I know, or they're French actors or something. Immediately, I'm like drawn into this world and I just love this whole setup. She calls her husband, tells him to come pick up the corpse. And the whole time she's referring to this child as if it's like a thing.
Yeah.
Like this horrible thing. I finally had the balls to kill it, and why don't you come pick it up? Throwing down the gauntlet.
Yeah, it didn't grab me the way it did you. And when you explain it, it sounds more interesting. Maybe it's because at that point, I was still like, I was in the movie theater. I'm so excited to be here, and I'm sort of waiting, you know, to be knocked out of my seat at that point. So I guess I'm just following the story and kind of waiting to see where it goes. I wasn't wowed by that opening scene.
But I was immediately sort of drawn in because I'm like, why did she kill this kid? Why is the kid eating a waste paper basket? Like, what is going on? Like, the mysteries that it set up, I thought were effective. I'm like, okay, I want to know what the hell's going on. Like,
so Sebastian, moving forward, are you defending this film?
Going to be shocked. I liked this film a lot.
Like, wow.
A lot. I really liked it. I don't know if it was because I'd just been to the doctor, so I was really in this headspace of like thinking about my body and my organs, but like, I understand there's things about the movie that are kind of a little creaky. Like, it feels like he's getting back into waters that he hasn't been in for a while, and he's not the director he used to be, you know?
Yeah.
But we all get older and we can't do things as well as we used to do.
Absolutely.
Yeah. However, I was not disappointed with the Cronenbergian elements that he threw in there. Like, going into the next scene, okay, we're introduced to Viggo Mortensen's character. First of all, Viggo Mortensen is an actor that I love. Right. He's playing this character with the name Saul Tenser, which is a name I fucking love. And he's this like weird sci-fi character who like walks around a lot of the time in like ninja hood. And at first I was like, okay, so is Saul Tenser walking around in a ninja hood because he doesn't want to be recognized? And then I realized, no, he's walking around like that because he's afraid of getting infected, right?
Yeah.
So the whole thing with him is he is a performance artist that grows organs in his body.
New undocumented organs, organs that aren't human.
That nobody's ever seen before. Yeah. So he's creating these new organs. And then his like creative, possibly romantic partner, played by Léa Seydoux, cuts them out of him. Well, first she like goes in and like tattoos them or something, and then
it's a little vague.
It's vague. And I do have questions about some of the logistics of things that happen in this movie, where I'm like, how did that happen? But I think they're just kind of not explaining certain things. Like, I think there's some sort of technology that eliminates scar tissue or something, because he doesn't look as scarred as you think he would be. And then later we're going to have something happen where a body has a bunch of like switched out organs in it. And it's like, how did it get there? Because there's no scarring. But whatever, that's a nitpick. This whole setup is just so awesomely weird, because he grows these new organs, which technically are cancerous. She tattoos them somehow, and then they pull them out of his body in front of an audience. And he sleeps in this weird bed that sort of has to adjust to his level of discomfort, because he's always uncomfortable because his body is growing these things. And I really appreciated Viggo Mortensen's performance, because his whole performance, you can tell he's like in pain. Like all of his lines are delivered in a way like, and he's got a weird accent going on. Like, it's off-putting. All of the performances are weirdly heightened and sort of almost comic booky, if you could call a David Cronenberg movie a comic book.
That's kind of his thing he does in his films. Like, his characters can be sort of two-dimensional in a comic book way, especially his the supporting characters.
And they tend to talk expositionally. Like, they just basically will tell you what the exposition you need to know. And it's, they're not even trying to hide it. Like, it's like almost everybody's character functions as sort of an exposition machine, like except for Saul and the Lea Seydoux character. I'm struggling at this point to find what you're disappointed in, because he's in this creepy Cronenberg bed that's like moving around. My favorite is like, what's it called? The Breakfaster? It's this like chair he gets into that just kind of like moves him around uncomfortably and like forces food into his mouth in a way that he'll be able to digest it properly. But it's got like that Cronenbergian like existence bone molding and stuff like that, almost Gigerish.
Yeah, it looks like a big gristly thing. The design of both of these, it's like they were lifted from a David Cronenberg movie, but then sort of put together like silly putty. I was not excited about the design of these things that you're talking about. And as far as the idea behind them, like what they're supposed to anticipate pain and help you eat and help you sleep. For some reason, I don't know, I was still just waiting to be fascinated at this point, and I wasn't. And as far as Viggo's performance in this, which he's great for his character, what he's given, but a character that is just making grumbly noises and constantly just like, you know, he can barely speak. Like a movie that where the main character is barely able to talk and he's just in pain the whole time. I don't know. I thought that wasn't working. There was something about that where I wanted him to get there, or I wanted to have different levels of it, but he was just like constantly barely able to get a word out.
Well, let me throw this idea at you, though. And I see what you're saying, but what I feel like in this movie, and maybe this is just kind of me bringing my own thing to it, I feel like really there's two main characters, right? There's Saul, and then there's Lea Seydoux's character, Caprice, right?
Yeah.
And I feel like she's kind of meant to be the emotional character, you know what I mean? Like, Saul's kind of bringing you in it. He's almost a detective.
Is he a detective? Because there is a detective in this movie, which I have no idea why.
Yeah, that's definitely the part about the movie that I didn't think was all that interesting.
I was hoping you could explain to me what the detective is doing in this
movie. The detective in this movie is part of an operation that is trying to stop this new evolution from happening. Like, it's a typical sort of Cronenbergian conspiracy kind of thing going on, very similar to what you see in Existence. Arguably not as effective as in that movie or the one in Naked Lunch. He loves those, like, oh, there's this whole kind of revolution going on underneath.
Yes, and he always does that.
Yeah. We have to try to stop it or whatever. I guess I'm just kind of responding to these things because I feel like this all feels like classic Cronenberg to me.
Yes.
Or like at least like the part of Cronenberg I liked. So I'm getting what I want pretty much. I mean, I understand, like, is this going into new territory? No, this feels very much of a piece of, I would say, with Existence and Naked Lunch.
Yeah, I never thought it was going into new territory either. And I loved that I was getting all the old devices that Cronenberg usually uses. I just felt like every time that was presented, it was kind of lukewarm. I was waiting for a new idea. And I, of course, I'm being hard on this film because I'm comparing it to his early works. And I know that's unfair. And I know that it's hard. It's pressure put on directors late in their careers to sort of wow you with an even better idea than they've done with their seminal works. But I guess I'm comparing, like, arbitrarily growing new organs that don't really do anything and having them removed as performance art compared to a stomach vagina that you can put videotapes into to program somebody with. Like, I'm just comparing it to ideas he's had before where it's like, holy shit.
Where I'm going to disagree with you is you're only talking about half the idea. The growing of the organs isn't the whole point. The point of the story is this is about humans trying to evolve. And the way that they're going to evolve is to learn to eat, like, all the fucking
plastic
crap yeah. that we leave around.
Yes.
Like, that's the big mystery that gets solved here, is this little boy who was killed in the beginning, his dad, who's played by Scott Speedman, who, if you're familiar with Scott Speedman, he's famous for being the heartthrob on Felicity, and he was in the Underworld movies. He is not an actor that garners any sort of respect. He's actually pretty good in The Strangers, that movie. But
I've never seen any of those. So, I mean, I've seen Underworld, but I can't remember him in there. He did look
familiar. He's just the hunky dude that's like a yeah. werewolf. But he's not an actor at all that ever sort of generates any sort of respect. And his performance in this movie is good. Like,
yes.
this is a side of Scott Speedman I've never seen. He actually plays like this layered character. And you're like, what's going on with this guy? Because, you know, he shows up to collect the body of his son who's been murdered by the mother. And then the plot of this movie is going to be he's going to go to Saul Tenser and he wants Saul and Caprice to perform an autopsy of his son as a
public display.
Yes. This is going to break the world wide open. When the world sees this, then the world's going to realize that, you know, I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yeah, but you know, all of these ideas are ridiculous, but fascinating. And I'm talking about like Cronenberg. In general, like, that, yes, they're ridiculous, but usually they're fascinating when you play around with them on a science fiction level.
Right. And I'm saying for me, that's working because
it's working for you.
This is cool. Like, when this performance art is happening, typically it's the Caprice character operating a little mushy Cronenberg remote device. And these blades are coming in and cutting into Vigo's flesh and removing the organs for the audience. So then at the climax of the movie, we're getting this different performance piece where they're cutting into this little boy on yeah. a table. And it's like pretty hardcore. I mean,
yeah, I'll give you that.
That would be very upsetting to most people. I'm surprised, too. Being the father of like a little boy who's like pretty much the age of this kid, you're not like kind of a little freaked out by that?
Yeah, I don't know. I just wasn't invested, especially at that point of the story. I was really not invested in this movie. And I could tell, like, okay, this is supposed to be really shocking. And for some reason, it just didn't hit me on a visceral level like some other things do. But just to add to context for what else is going on in this movie, yes, people are, you know, Saul Tenser is doing these performances where he's being cut open. He's fully awake as this is happening. But for some reason, which is never really explained, people aren't experiencing pain anymore.
Right.
Like there's some technology that has eliminated pain for people. So there's this subtext going around where people enjoy cutting into each other.
That gets a little lost.
These little surgeries. And I think it's this kind of stuff that was starting to turn me off from the larger part of the story. So like in the beginning of the movie or early on in the movie, Saul Tenser's walking down the street and there's these people that look like they should be like making out in a corner in a seedy alleyway. And what are they actually doing? One of them has like a pocket knife and he's sort of like cutting into this girl and she's getting off on it. And then there's this idea that's circulating around that surgery is the new sex. I think for all of these things, a lot of these ideas that were mildly being presented never went anywhere or never helped the narrative. They were just sort of there to be edgy. I don't know. Or they just weren't explored. At every step when these things were happening, and we'll get more and more into it, there's a lot of things where it's like, here's an idea. It doesn't even matter if they're half-baked because I feel like in prior Cronenberg movies, you can, like you mentioned, some of these ideas are just ridiculous, but they're explored and they continue through the narrative. And however bizarre they are, they become so much a part of these characters and what they're doing. And I felt like lukewarm is the best phrase I can use to describe this. These ideas were sort of handed to you halfway thought out and never really going anywhere. And I kept waiting for how these things were going to add up. So this like surgery is the new sex thread that was sort of being tossed around in here. Like at one point, Saul Tenser is in this performance art. And just to sort of describe how these performance pieces worked, like you said, they kind of had this Cronenberg world, which he's always had a great production designer, Carol Spear, who has kind of created these, you know, rooms where paint is flaking off the wall and they're very dark and grimy and moldy. Like that's a very much common thing, a setting for him, you know. So they're in this room, people are using vintage Super 8 cameras to record the events, which I don't know, that's cool. But there's never an explanation as to why. But here we are listening to vinyl records in the age of free digital music. So
I do have a theory on that.
Okay.
My theory is, and this is not spelled out in the movie, but I think it's fair to extrapolate when you're talking about Cronenberg movies. Because at one point, they go and they have this interaction with Don McKellar, who's a sort of notable Canadian actor who I remember a lot from 90s indie stuff.
Yeah, I love Don McKellar.
And Kristen Stewart, surprisingly.
Okay, Kristen Stewart is my favorite part about this movie.
I think she's awesome in this movie. She's, I thought, incredible. You were going to say she wasn't good. Because
no.
You could easily say her performance isn't good.
No.
Because it's a weird performance.
I love Kristen Stewart in this movie. So the two things I was going to say, my favorite takeaways from this film is I actually really do like the new Howard Shore score. And I love Kristen Stewart. She is my favorite part about this movie.
She's playing this bureaucrat. There are these two bureaucrats who run this like government organization. I forget what it's called. There's all these Cronenbergian, awesomely weird bureaucratic names. And it's just like this grimy office somewhere, right?
It's like the Oregon Registry or something.
Yeah, you've got to, if you have a new organ, you have to go to them and have it registered with the government, which that's what their job is to do. But they're also both like kind of pervy enthusiasts about this whole thing, especially Kristen Stewart, right? She's the one who actually says surgery is the new sex.
Right.
She comes to him after a performance and sort of whispers that hotly in his ear. And like, there's some weird sexual chemistry between her and Viggo Mortensen, which I sort of enjoyed, even though they're very far apart in age. It's through them that we're getting these sort of hints of this weird organ bureaucracy, things that are going on in the background, things you're supposed to be doing, but things you shouldn't be doing. And to tie it back into why they're using Super 8 cameras and everything, because there's this scene where they are looking at the new organ that's inside Viggo Mortensen with these cool little ocular cameras that are fed into tubes. And Léa Seydoux has this high-tech recording device that's like a ring. And she's recording it because she wants to use this, you know, exploration as part of the performance piece. But then Kristen Stewart's like, you can't tape this.
Yeah, she's like, turn that off, turn that off. You can't record any of this. It's illegal.
I would assume that that device is probably high tech and probably connects to whatever passes for the internet or whatever in this fucked up world.
Yeah.
But those older cameras don't.
Well, actually, that's a great point.
That's the way you can actually get away with filming stuff is by using old technology because it's not jacked into the system or whatever.
Yeah. And they have old CRT monitors around in these performances, old video technology and old actual film that they're recording these performances with. But that's a good point. And, you know, that's an interesting way to connect that.
I get what you're saying, the way that kind of where this movie ends up going, and it's sort of what seems to be its central thesis, which is that surgery is the new sex, you know, and we're hearkening back to Long Live the New Flesh from Videodrome and all that. It's very clearly coming from the same place. I feel like that's kind of what he does, is he sort of sets up this central idea. And then there's this other idea that kind of sneaks out from under that idea. And he finds a way to sort of connect it. And the other idea is that this is about humans trying to evolve.
Yeah.
The Scott Speedman character, we see him eating this candy bar that's this purple candy bar, which I love because it kind of looks delicious. Like, I kind of want to eat it. But then this other character eats one of those bars and like immediately has seizures and pukes all over himself and dies. We're going to later find out that that was like an agent that they put undercover to try to get into this organization. And Scott Speedman like got him to eat the candy bar and that's what killed him. But Scott Speedman is this new evolved human being that can consume plastics. And that's what these candy bars are. And the crazy part is, and this is where I think if you are honestly like interested in evolutionary science, this is where you're probably going to run into a problem. And the movie even kind of admits this.
Yeah.
The Scott Speedman character and all these other people that he's in league with, this cabal, the shadowy cabal, if you want to call them, they have done this to themselves through surgery. They have somehow changed their inner organs to be able to process plastics as sustenance.
Because they feel like they are pushing the survival of the human race, and they're trying to figure out a technical way to do that.
Right. And his son was born naturally.
Yeah.
That means that their surgery somehow, which is impossible and could never ever happen.
But they do bring that up.
Had an evolutionary effect. Yes, they do bring it up. They're like, that would be impossible.
There's a great line where somebody says, like, you know, if I cut my finger off, does that mean my son is going to be born without a finger? Like, how did you do that?
Yeah, Saul says it.
So they address it, but they never pose an explanation.
Yeah, they hand wave it. They're like, yep, that's just what happened, right. Which I kind of love, especially from a writing standpoint. Like, whenever you're writing anything that's either fantasy or science fiction, like, no matter how well thought out your ideas are, you always sort of arrive at this nexus point, right?
Yeah.
Where it's like, this doesn't make sense, really.
Yeah, and as a fiction writer, that's not your job to propose a new technology and say, I invented this.
Right, that's for inventors and scientists to do in the real world. The job of a fiction writer is to explore with ideas in ways that couldn't really happen.
Right.
That's the whole point, which is why it really bugs me when people get pedantic about this stuff, like, that wouldn't really happen. Like, no shit, it wouldn't really happen, or else it would have. Like, Star Wars didn't really happen because it couldn't. That's why it's fun. I do appreciate that the movie arrives right at that point. And this is what I love about Cronenberg. He's so smart. He knows. He's like, I know this would not make sense, but we'll talk about it and I don't fucking care.
Right. And he kind of says this doesn't make sense right in the screenplay. Out of all of his movies, I'm going to say he's my favorite director, but I'm not going to say like any of his movies are like my favorite movies. But what he has brought to cinema, I think, is this imagination that I haven't seen from anybody else. And when you actually hear his commentaries,
they're amazing. He is so succinct. I listened to his commentary for The Fly. It is one of the most incredible commentaries ever, because he leads you through that whole movie. He explains every idea, how he implemented it, why he implemented it.
Yes.
And then by the end of the commentary, at the very last frame, he like arrives at his thesis and he's like, and that's what the movie is about.
Yeah.
Credits. And I'm like, that is fucking amazing.
All his commentaries are like that. And even when he's talking about his, you know, quote unquote schlockier films like Shivers and Rabid, he'll be talking as if he's this college professor and saying like, why these things are happening? Like, why are we growing, parasites he leads you through this whole well thought out idea for like a vampire movie with leeches and parasites. And so he's always had this like collegiate professor demeanor about him. And I could sit through a 4-hour lecture with this guy and just be like completely engaged. And I think that's why he's my favorite director, because it's his whole world that he's creating. He definitely has a sense of style cinematically. Some people are not as excited about it. And I'd say it's very subtle, what he's doing cinematically. It's very Canadian. I've seen Adam McGoyan also kind of similarly have his characters play like downplayed and stuff. But yeah, I'd say that's why I love Cronenberg, is with every movie, especially ones that he's writing, the ones that he's bringing from his own imagination, brings these crazy ideas and disturbing ideas and takes you to these places where only this man can bring you to. It's not repetitive. It's not referential from other genres. It is this completely wild idea that is so unique to him. So I think that's why when, in this movie, I wanted it to be a return. There's some people that really enjoy this movie.
I'm one of them.
All my other friends that have seen this hated it. Like the friend that I went to with the theater, he walked out and was like, I fucking hated that movie. And I'd say he's, always enjoyed prior Cronenberg. This friend of mine actually went to see Crash in the 90s with me in college and, liked that one pretty well too. But people are having mixed feelings about Crimes of the Future.
Yeah.
But me personally, I feel like he was digging up some ideas that he has already played with and did not explore them. The sole premises of this movie is, like you said, people are trying to figure out how to adapt in a world where we're drowning in our own waste, right? And plastic and microplastics are already in our bloodstreams, and our children are being born with these things. So that's an interesting idea. Where he went with this, it just, to me, felt lackluster. It's like he sort of presented it. Yes, we're living in a world that's kind of falling apart. We have to figure out how to adapt in a world where poisons are invading our ecosystems. So a performance artist is going to grow new organs, and there's kind of some registry for the new organs.
I can agree with you that it doesn't really connect as well as you might want it to, And like the idea of surgery is the new sex doesn't quite perfectly lock into, we need to evolve to eat plastic.
I think on that level too, like what this movie essentially was about, I just felt like wasn't that interesting of a premise. None of it grabbed me. I kept waiting, like, okay, where is he going with this? Are we going to explore this? And it never really seemed to be explored. And then the main characters being these performance artists, that especially never grabbed me. And he's played around with characters like this before, multiple times. Going back to Scanners, there were like artists in that dealing with their conditions that were changing and evolving. There was a scanner artist in that movie. I actually thought that was really fascinating. And in Crash, which I think this movie is very similar to in a lot of ways, all of those main characters were performance artists. That's what they were doing. And they were looking at the human evolution and its relationship to cars, and cars are an extension of our bodies, and getting into crashes can be sensual and sexy. And this, right. You know, that's what the original source material was about as well. But I thought like that was fascinating, and that grabbed me and took me into a disturbing and weird place. And when this was presented, like, here's performance artists and he lies on a table and has his organs taken out. And then he, after the performance, it sits in a jar and he lies in like a chaise lounge and talks to people. Like, that's it. That's all we're getting is like, you know, you sit there and you're like, yeah, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate you. Like, I love you, Soul Tensor. You're the greatest performer. Thanks a lot. Glad you came out to the show.
Yeah, I guess I'm just kind of just enjoying the presentation of these ideas. I'm sort of shallowly not really needing it to drill down much more, pun intended. I'm just kind of like, that's a crazy idea. I love it.
Yeah, and I think that's where I differ. I never thought that they were really crazy ideas. Even the kid eating plastic. That's the beginning of an interesting idea, but it's not presenting an actual crazy idea. The most shocking thing about Crimes of the Future is that you seem to love this movie. I'm shocked.
I wouldn't say love, but I definitely liked it a lot.
I never expected that.
I was dreading it. You saw how long I put off watching it.
Let's just add, I don't think we've mentioned that you just watched it.
Yeah.
Now, it took you this long. This movie, how many months ago did this come out?
A long time.
And usually you're first in line to see any piece of shit.
Because you were so unenthusiastic about it. You're like the Cronenberg guy. That would be like, I don't know, me seeing a Batman movie. If there was a Batman movie that came out and I was like, it sucks, you would not see it.
I wouldn't watch it. No, superheroes aren't as much my thing. So yeah. I can see that. But this is you love horror.
Yeah, I liked it.
I downplayed this movie too much.
Yeah, I mean, you definitely set my expectations super low. And there was definitely moments there where I felt my attention sort of drifting because it's very kind of deliberately paced and slow, although it doesn't overstay its welcome. It's not that long of a movie.
No.
It gets out, I think, at a reasonable time. I don't know, every scene that would come up, I'd be like, okay, this has got something in it for me, other than the scenes where, as you mentioned, Saul is meeting with the cop.
Detective at like a shipyard. What happened in that scene? I've seen it twice now. I cannot tell you what that exchange was about.
Well, there's a couple of them, and they're basically like the detective is setting up the idea that there's this underground movement going on, and that's why they need Saul's help, is because he's sort of on the ground in this world and he can figure it out. This whole relationship Saul has with this cop is all done in media res, right? Like, it's supposed to be this big reveal that, oh, and Saul's working with the police and Lea Seydoux doesn't even know about it. And this doesn't ever even...
It never goes anywhere.
She never even finds out that he's been doing this.
And this is my biggest problem with the movie, is none of these things seem to go anywhere.
Let me ask you this. If they tacked on like another 15 minutes and kind of did a little bit more of exploring of ideas and tied things together a little bit better, would you maybe like the movie a little more?
I think I would. I think I would. And here's the biggest letdown for me. There was an idea proposed that actually was fascinating, which was from Don McKellar was in charge of this inner beauty contest.
Yes.
And they mentioned this and I was like, okay, that sounds fucking awesome. They have this conversation where he's in the registry and Don McKellar takes him to another like secret room. And he says, I've been keeping this a bit of a secret, but we really want you to be a contestant in our inner beauty contest.
And what they mean by that is literally the beauty of his insides.
Of his organs. And I thought, now we're going somewhere. And that's when I thought, okay, now this movie is like going to the next level. This is where it starts picking up the pace. And they never mentioned it again.
Yeah.
Kristen Stewart may have mentioned it, but they completely dropped that ball.
Yeah.
After that. No mention of it ever again. And I thought, that's naturally where this film should have been heading. And they didn't. It's just kind of like the other ideas kind of played out a little bit.
Yeah.
So that's where I felt like this movie didn't add up. It didn't seem to go where it should have. Some of the things got resolved, some of the things didn't, and just kind of fell flat. And that's why.
Well, and to your point, there's also a scene where he goes and gets a zipper put in his stomach. You know, later he shows up with Leah Sadu and she like unzips his zipper and puts her hands in it.
It doesn't work because they're already, we've watched half the movie so far where they have all these devices to perform the surgery. This is what they do for a living. And then he sort of gets this streamlined way of opening it up. And actually that sort of takes all the steam out of it. Like, you know, well, if you can just unzip and show, you know, here it is, here's my organs, that deflates your entire performance.
Yeah.
Yeah. I felt like that idea didn't work. He's done that before in his movies where, you know, now we have an even better and weirder way of having our character do their already strange thing.
Yeah.
You know, it's the, even that's the next cycle. It's the next device. Like there was a lot of that in Existence and it took you to yet another weird place. And yeah, the zipper thing was kind of trying to do that. I don't think we even saw it again after that. It's like, yeah, he's got a zipper.
No, you're definitely right. There's a couple of things that really are kind of set up that don't go anywhere. I can't argue that.
And to my nitpicky super fandom being really hard on Cronenberg, I felt like the things that were presented, you know, the bed, the eater chair and stuff, weren't that well designed. I guess the design of them and stuff, they just didn't, the chair looked kind of like a bad armature kind of thing that was wonky. And
I liked it. It was fun to me in the same way, like seeing old aliens from the first Star Wars in like one of the new shows is.
I do like that there was a lot of practical. I like that a lot of these things were practical.
Well, and I loved the sort of fetishization. There's these two women characters who are like,
okay, let's talk about these technicians. Yes, the Sark technicians.
Did you not like them? Because I loved them. I thought they were awesome.
They were definitely a more fun part of this movie.
Well, yeah, this is where the humor is.
The kinky, yeah, they're funny, they're comical, they're almost like this old style, like Laurel and Hardy kind of duo. They're sexy, that, you know, we see them mess around in one of the chairs.
Yeah, they strip off their clothes at one point and get in one of the devices, and they come to service all of these Cronenbergian devices, and they, you know, they know all the models and everything like that. Yeah. And they're sort of like running commentary the whole time of like, you know, what this model does, and this actually was used for autopsies or whatever, setting up that it's going to be an autopsy later.
They're almost exactly the same character as William Dafoe's character in Existence.
I love those characters.
I do too. But so what happened with them? Then they became assassins.
Yes.
And I completely missed where that was going. I got lost.
It's not laid out clearly. The movie might come to a definitive answer on that, and I might have missed it. But
yeah,
what happens is after the autopsy of the little boy goes wrong, because they open up the little boy and they were expecting to find these new organs in there, these new evolved organs. But what's in there is actually his organs have somehow been replaced, and now the organs in there are all tattooed and all messed up or whatever.
From his mom, right?
No.
No.
That's how it looks. It's made to look that way because it says like mother tattooed on one of the organs, which earlier in the movie, Saul's like, you should get a tattoo or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, mother or whatever. Yeah. Like the sort of typical type of things you would see on a normal tattoo, like an anchor or the word mother. And in this case, the actual word mother is written on one of his organs, which implicates that the mother was the one that did this. And the mother's in jail. She's turned herself in, admitted to murdering the kids. So, you know, she would have nothing to lose here.
I'm sorry. So I'm confused. So explain to me, when they opened up the boy,
yes,
they cut him open, you see all his organs in there tattooed, and everybody like, you know, there's these gasps of breath and people are sort of astonished. Why?
Well, people are gasping because that's upsetting. They don't know that they were set up to see something different. Only Scott Speedman and Saul know that what they're supposed to see is new organs inside him that can digest plastic.
Okay.
And that's going to be the thing that the whole world now sees, that humans have evolved to this new thing. But that's not what's in there. What's in there is just his organs have been messed with and tattooed, and they're like covered in gunk and stuff like that. So it just looks like a mother did something horrible to her child, and that's why it's so shocking.
So who did that? Who did that to the boy?
Kristen Stewart.
Oh.
She did it. She put those organs in the boy so that the world wouldn't see the truth.
Okay. That was very confusing. Again, these things don't really add up very well.
They definitely don't. They definitely don't all add up, but I'm not really necessarily dinging the movie for that. I'm kind of okay with it.
Yeah.
Like, because I don't really care.
Some of my favorite movies don't make a lick of sense, and I completely get that.
On the same note, though, I get why that's not necessarily going to work for people. Yeah. You know, like, I get it. It's not like this movie isn't trying to connect the dots.
Well, that's the thing. It's ultimately kind of a mystery, right? This movie is a mystery. And so you've got a detective character, you've got some organizations that are playing against each other, you have assassins, and this is all Cronenberg stuff. This is stuff he's played around before. And before in his movies, they sometimes play out in unexpected ways. They're not the typical ways these characters and themes would play out. But I think because this movie was sort of set up like, there's something fishy going on and we have to sort of check out what's... And then it just doesn't really lead you down that road. And it's just... If you're going to set it up that way, you need to have some beats that work. Even if it's weird, even if it leads you to another confusing area, you need to follow up with those beats. And I felt like this didn't even have those beats. None of this is working. And so what we're getting a kind of Cronenberg world. And there's that character we've kind of familiar with. And, you know, there's some ideas here that are being thrown around in a science fiction way. There's no beats. None of these things are landing at the part where we're like, okay, we've arrived at this point where they found something out, but not really. That kind of leads to my main argument, which is where there was this great idea that was presented about this inner beauty contest where I felt like, okay, doesn't matter. All those things that weren't leading anywhere before don't matter because we're going to get to this fucking beauty contest.
Again, you're now choosing something that you're more interested in and wanting the movie to go there and not judging the movie with what it is giving you. You're asking the movie to give you something that you want that it's not giving you.
What is the movie giving me?
It's giving you this idea. I won't say exploration because I do agree with you that these things aren't explored to necessarily anyone's satisfaction, but it's, you know, it's trying to wrestle with concepts of evolution.
Yeah.
You know, arguably it's failing to do so depending on how you feel about it, but I don't think you can really come to any sort of real conclusion. You know, all you can really do is kind of throw out the idea. I think that the intention of the film is to kind of have it be this sort of big twist slash reveal that what this has all been about this whole time is about people consuming plastics as a stage of evolution. And I think the problem with that, why that doesn't totally work narratively, is because we've all been building up to this climax, right? Which is going to be this autopsy scene, right?
For the boy.
Yeah, this public autopsy.
Yeah.
But we, the audience, already know the answer to what this is before, because we have this scene where Scott Speedman like brings them to a freezer in some slimy room, shows them the body of the boy, and he lays it all out. He lays everything out. He's like, lifts up his shirt and shows that all his scars, and I changed my organs and so I could consume plastic, and then he was born and he had this evolution despite it being impossible, all this kind of stuff. We already know now what the central thesis of the movie is, but then you get this climax where the point of the climax is that it doesn't happen the way he wants it to, which is fine, but typically what you'd want to do is you would want to reveal those things at the same time, right?
Yes.
So that it's like, oh my God, this is what it's been the whole time?
Or if you're trying to twist that and have it not play out the way they wanted to, explain what that is. That's where I was confused. I was like, wait, what happened?
Well, they do explain what it is. And then it's just a weird dramatic beat. You were talking about how the beats don't play.
Yeah.
And I think you're right. I think you're landing on something there that's right, which is weird about this movie, is the information that he wants you to know gets doled out.
Yeah.
But it doesn't get doled out in a dramatically satisfying way.
Yes. Yes.
That you just kind of learn these things. I think the whole beauty pageant thing is just a joke. It's not an idea. It's just a funny joke. He's just trying to have fun.
It seemed like if you got a movie about performance artists presenting to the world what's happening, that just seemed like the natural place for you to go.
I don't disagree with you. I'm just saying what I think his intention was is to make a joke.
I guess it was kind of a long scene where he talked it up, though. It was, you know, and he said, this is a big secret, and this is a secret room where I'm planning this, and this is, you know, it didn't feel like a disposable idea at that moment.
The thing that's weird about that, though, is like, okay, so if you're setting up this idea of a beauty pageant, just like writing 101, then you got to have the beauty pageant, right? Like,
yes.
if that's gonna, and that's going to be your climax, right? I mean, what else would it be?
Or have immediately dispel it, immediately say, like, that's fucking dumb. And then we understand it's a joke. But it didn't. It left it wide open. So I thought we were going there.
Yeah, I think it's just he's doing a weird thing with dramatic beats where he's either trying to subvert expectations or he's just setting things up as a joke and he's not really interested in exploring them. He set things up so that he really can't have a climax in which all these things converge in a way that's satisfying. So he's going to just kind of lay it out beforehand and then have the scene play out in a way that you're not expecting. And so that's going to be the satisfying element of watching the scene. I don't know. It's impossible to know. It's too bad that this movie isn't getting a physical release with like a commentary, because I think like a commentary for this would be totally interesting.
I would love a commentary about this. I don't know if he really does those anymore, but this is like one film where I desperately need a commentary track and would fill in all the blanks for me. Even if it didn't, it would just be like, this is also an idea that he started apparently writing in the 90s, like right around the same time as Existence. So this was supposed to be yet another project that was in that vein, which would have been interesting.
Supposedly it was going to star Ralph Fiennes at one point and then Nicolas Cage at one point, which
wow.
I could totally see.
Yeah.
I could see that.
Oh, that would have been amazing.
It had a higher budget then. Like the budget actually came down.
Do you know what happened? Like why this never happened?
He just
happened?
Couldn't get it made. It was just one of those things where he just couldn't get it financed. And then at one point he was like, forget it. I'm not interested in that idea anymore, which sheds a little light as to why there are these vestigial elements of ideas, because at a certain point it may have been about the beauty pageant.
Yeah.
And then it took him so long to get it made that he was like, I'm not interested in that beauty pageant idea anymore, but I like that scene, so that'll stay in.
But that's exactly how this movie plays out to me. It feels like it's a movie that was made by somebody who was getting tired of exploring its own ideas. That's how I felt watching it. I just felt like, yeah, I kind of like this. This is cool. And here's a scene with this. And, you know, we're going to move on to this other thing and other scenes that kind of go in this area. But I don't know. I kind of feel, let's go over here.
Right.
That's how it felt.
It feels like an idea that's been around a long time and it's gotten a little stale in the creator's mind. And he still likes elements of the idea, but now he wants to look at different things that are related to it.
That's exactly how I read this movie. It just felt like that. And I kind of, being a huge Cronenberg fan, and I hate bashing this movie because I love that he tried to do this. Take something off the shelf that's 20 years old and try to actually get it out there and make it. And I think that's awesome. But it felt stale. Yes.
Yeah.
It felt like, oh, I'm tired of thinking about these ideas. And I already know I've sort of have my answers for them. And
yeah.
So it didn't feel enthusiastic and like a writer who's just like, I have no idea where this is going. It's fucking crazy, but I'm going to make the scene and it's going to be wild and I don't understand it myself, but let's keep going. It just felt like, yeah, I've talked about these ideas before and Yeah.
Well, and that makes sense then for me that I kind of enjoyed it because I kind of love those movies while being able to sort of accept that they're flawed. But, you know, like Gangs of New York for Scorsese
is a good example.
One of those, which I like that movie.
I like it too.
That has that feel too. You know what I mean? Of like, this has been kicking around forever.
Yeah.
And he's probably had other ideas that he's moved on from. And so now we're going to do this. And I mean, I think that movie is arguably more successful than this movie.
You see this a lot in the last part of stages of these careers and these directors.
Right.
Like either they do want to kind of do this, or maybe they feel pressured to have to bring out the old hits and kind of play the old tracks again.
But I don't think it's that. I think it's eventually somebody comes around with money and is like, hey, you want to make that dream project that you always had lying around? We'll fund it. And they're like, all right, well, dust off the old script.
And you kind of get a handful of those with John Carpenter, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you know, The Ward. These films where it's just like, they just don't have the energy to go crazy with it. And I get that. Like I'm almost 50 and I feel too tired to do anything, you know? So I completely understand.
And isn't like Cronenberg almost 80 now or some shit?
Oh, yeah.
Like, he's really old.
He's really old. So I appreciate that he went, I really appreciate that he went there. You know, he's enjoying the success of his career and he has that sandbox that he can do that with now. I am criticizing it for just falling a little flat in areas and being kind of stale. And I was admittedly kind of bored in this movie.
Yeah, that's one thing that I definitely wasn't. Like, okay. I can get on board with most of your criticisms and think that they're totally on point while still kind of just not caring because I kind of liked it.
You liked seeing what was around the next corner.
I was never bored, no.
Okay.
I mean, there were moments where I was kind of like, my interest was maybe waning a little bit because, you know, the way he stages scenes tends to be kind of flat purposefully.
Yeah, which I like. I kind of love that about him.
It's very Canadian. Like, you know, not a lot of bells and whistles, usually two people talking, and he's not interested in pacing it in any real way. So it's just kind of, you can get bored. And maybe I was watching it at the right time of day with the right level of caffeine in my system, you know? And also, I think your setting of expectations helped a lot because I was expecting to be bored the whole time.
Yeah.
I was dreading it.
Yes.
I was dreading watching this movie. And I was like, hey, no, I'm kind of into this. And then, I was like, well, it'll probably get bad and I'll start to not like it. And it never quite lost me. I mean, there were those scenes with the cop that weren't very exciting, but all movies have those scenes. So
why is it always a fucking cop? There's always that character. I swear to God. And it's in genre movies like this, where halfway through the movie, a goddamn detective shows up for any reason at all. It's just part of these storylines.
Because boomers love their detectives, man. They love their noir and they love their detectives.
It's in everything. The Exorcist has that detective, that gumshoe detective that like shows up halfway through.
Right. Why the fuck is he in that movie?
They're always in these movies. Let's fast forward to my biggest letdown in this movie, which is the climax. Because you were kind of mentioning that, I guess there's this first climax where they do this autopsy on the boy. It's supposed to be a kind of a climactic scene, but I'm going to the actual end of the movie and we're getting that Cronenberg reveal, you know, right before the credits come on, the Howard Shore music kind of builds up, sort of starts swelling. There's this tension. We've seen this a lot in his body of work where the character arrives at this place. Like in Videodrome, it was James Woods comes to be the new flesh and he like shoots himself in the head and becomes an organ mess or something. And like,
hold on a minute here. Are you saying you don't think Viggo Mortensen eating a candy bar?
A fucking power bar? Is that what I'm saying? That the climax of this movie, him gobbling a power bar and crying, didn't land as the most climactic reveal.
Technically, I think from a dramatic standpoint, I would call this the denouement, not the climax. But at the same time, though, I was kind of like, oh, okay, that kind of ties the room together a little bit, you know?
It may have been this moment in the movie where I just was like, fuck this movie.
Like, well, but that's the end of the movie. I mean, it's cut to but credits.
Are you leaving us with this? Viggo Mortensen chowing down on a Clif Bar.
Dude, those candy bars looked delicious. Those purple candy bars? I would house one of those motherfuckers. Are you kidding? I want to run out to the concession stand and see like a row of purple candy bars. Like
a Wonka bar, like merchandise. This is the only piece of merchandise from this movie is the purple
Saul
candy.
The Saul Tensor.
It shows up in a 7-Eleven. You can get your Cronenberg Saul Tensor power bar.
I'm going to make a mixed drink, the Saul Tensor, that's like a purple, like gummy, gooey drink with like a fake organ in it. Mm.
Like a little onion that looks like a gizzard or something. But yeah, tell me that this ending...
Well, look, when you put it that way, right. Sure, yeah. I mean, when you're comparing it to Videodrome or even The Fly and...
It falls fucking flat. This ending.
Well, then it cuts to black and white weirdly.
Yeah, and that made it even worse for me. It's like shot through her little ring cam that she's, so it's like this sort of bad black and white video footage that's right up on his face. Like it's, you know, it's like shot with this bad video image and he's just taking these bites out of this candy bar. And then you kind of can almost see him like crying and you get that sort of like moment where it's like just black. Oh my God, he ate the bar. He ate
it. Well, he
it.
Can digest it. He can
digest it. It solved all of his
He's
problems.
He's one of the new people. It's the same ending as the Videodrome. It's just way sillier. And I kind of like it because David Cronenberg's an 80-year-old man. He probably has to really be careful about what he eats at this point.
So he probably ate a new fiber cereal and had that epiphany one day. He's like, oh my God. This nature grain, what? I don't have gas anymore. Like, I got to write this in my movie.
Yeah, he ate a power bar and he was like, oh my God, this is the new food. Yeah, it's lame when you put it that way. I mean, look, you know, I literally just stopped watching this movie, so I didn't really have time to process this. I was kind of like, huh, okay, well, I get it. He can digest that. Yeah. Cool.
The movie could have used a better ending.
I agree. I at least appreciate that you, as a super fan, are going in the other direction and you're not convincing yourself that this is amazing, because I think this movie is good enough that if you were a super fan, you could convince yourself that it's way better than it is.
I feel like there are people out there doing that. This seems to be getting decent reviews.
I think that's the way movie experiences are now.
Yeah. Like,
it's either the greatest thing or the worst thing.
Yeah.
And that's just how everybody reacts to everything now. Hyperbole.
I try to keep myself in check, but I've already done this with a lot of Cronenberg's other work. Like I watched History of Violence and I was like, that's pretty good. Like I've already been kind of playing that role a lot. Like Cosmopolis, had some cool stuff in it. There's like Paul Giamatti had a weird gun, you know, like I've already been in this spot several times. So I kind of felt like with this one, and maybe it's because he went back to that area. And if you put this side by side with his other work, it's just not there. So it's very easy to compare this to the other body horror movies and be like, this one's just not, you can't put it in the same place as Scanners or something. So
I would be interested to watch like Videodrome and Existenz and this. I mean, I feel like that's kind of almost like a triptych. Cherry pick specifically the Cronenberg films that this specifically slots in. You know, like, yeah. I would say Videodrome for sure, right?
Yes.
I would say...
I think it's pretty similar to Crash, to be honest. Yeah.
Right. So let's say Videodrome, Crash, Existenz, and this, right? Like you could say these four are kind of the same cinematic fabric,
right.
Let's call it, right? I bet you this would not compare favorably if you watch those four movies in a row.
Yeah. Leading up to going out to see this in the theater, I did kind of watch all those. I was like watching my whole Cronenberg library and getting kind of excited, seeing how these things piece together, how similar they are. And so right after having watched all of those, this was the weakest one.
All right. Well, I'm going to go, grow a new organ and eat a plastic waste paper basket and perform an autopsy on a...
Don't. No.
Boy.
Oh. You went there.
That about does it today for Tentpole Trauma. If you like what you heard, check out our social media presence on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Just look for Tentpole Trauma. That was easy, wasn't it? If you like us, hit subscribe and leave us a sterling review on iTunes, if you dare. If you really like us, head over to patreon.com and get involved in one of our fabulous tiers. You'll be glad you did. Want to communicate with Tentpole Trauma? Send an email to tentpoletrauma@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. And who knows, one day you may even get your email read on one of our shows. Well, thanks for listening, and we'll see you real soon.